Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Beirut, Lebanon, and speak with Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe, and discuss the growing You Stink movement that has occupied the offices of Lebanon's environment minister, whose resignation they are demanding because of the piles of uncollected garbage festering in the streets as a result of a political dispute. A Beirut-based journalist, Thanasi now finds himself living amongst mountains of trash that highlights the country's gridlock and corruption and its political dysfunction and paralysis. Then we'll examine the undeclared cyber war underway between the United States and China and the U.S. and Russia, and speak with August Cole, a writer and analyst specializing in national security issues. He is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, where he directs the Art of Future Warfare Project, and is the co-author with Peter Singer of Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. We will discuss how China's and Russia's intelligence services are aggressively aggregating and cross-referencing hacked data from U.S. government databases, as well as medical records and other data hacked from private companies like Ashley Madison that allows them to build dossiers on all U.S. spies. Then finally, we will look back on the Egyptian Revolution and the Arab Spring that brought hope for change in the Middle East, only to provoke a counter-revolution financed by Saudi Arabia that brought back Egypt's military rulers, who have long dominated the country and are now jailing so many political opponents and reformers that the jails are overflowing. Noah Radwan, a professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley, who participated in the 2011 Tahrir protests, joins us to discuss the current sad realities of life in Egypt today. And joining us now from Beirut is Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
A pleasure to talk to you, Ian.
And you have just returned from the demonstrations in central Beirut by the You Stink movement. They've occupied the offices of Lebanon's environment minister, whose resignation they're demanding, but I understand they've been evicted from those offices.
Yeah, they were violently evicted in a pretty thuggish way by the security forces. Essentially, they were lined up outside this minister's door, and the police came in, and the first thing they did was they ejected the reporters and cut off the live television feed, and then they told the demonstrators to leave or they'd be beaten up, and then they proceeded to start beating them up. This was sort of typical incompetent thuggery for two reasons. One, just because it's brutal and unnecessary. And two, because these guys were not smart enough to realize that the activists still had a live video feed going from their cell phones. So several of these beatings were broadcast live on television, and that actually created a much larger demonstration outside than had been going on previously. At this point in the night, it's 11 o'clock here at night, that demonstration has finally sort of frizzled out. But this is definitely a case of the misbehavior by the government making things worse rather than containing the dissatisfaction and letting the problem try to go away.
And the focus of the demonstrators, the You Stink demonstrators who are protesting the piles of mountains of garbage piling up on the streets and festering in the sun there for days and if not weeks. Mohamed Majnouk, who is the environment minister, I don't know him, but I have this impression that he's kind of a caricature of a completely corrupt and incompetent politician. Am I correct?
Well, right. The whole government and state is sort of paralyzed by incompetence and corruption, and it's an oligarchy of kleptocrats, they've been colluding for decades to not really run the Lebanese state, but to control it to their advantage. And the brilliance of this movement is that instead of sort of overtly taking head on the powerful families and the powerful political parties that control Lebanon, or, you know, the colossal problem of sectarianism, or the sort of colossal but vague problem of corruption, they've just focused on one thing, trash, right? Trash, even in a place as messed up as Lebanon, the trash used to get picked up, and things are so have reached such an impasse of incompetence in the government that by the time the summer rolled around, the trash pickup stopped, and they couldn't even do that. So that was like a basic service that even at its worst, Lebanon had managed to deliver. And now even that has fallen victim to basically fighting over contract spoils. So the old contract comes up, and all these different fat cats who sit in the government want a piece of the new garbage contract. And because they can't decide who gets to steal how much from the garbage contract, there's no new garbage contract. No one picks up the garbage. And so this movement has very cleverly and minimalistically said, you know, this is the problem we want to fix. And they've picked on one guy, and this environment minister, he's not from Hezbollah, he's not from March 14th, he's not from any of the major parties. And that, you know, it seems a little bit unfair, right, because these major parties are the people who ruin the country, and this guy is sort of a semi-independent crony of the presidency, of the prime minister. And yet, at the same time, again, this is tactically brilliant because they pick on this guy and they can just say, we're picking on this one problem. It's not, you know, and none of the major warlords get their backs up because he's not their guy. And as you said, he does really symbolize, I would say, less than corruption, just rank incompetence. I mean, this is a guy who has a pretty tiny mandate and a pretty minor ministry, and he can't even do basic things like explain how this contract process is going to work or how it could be resolved. So it's a real embarrassment.
And again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, who's in Beirut, Lebanon, where he writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. But given that these demonstrations from this spontaneous movement, the You Stink movement, as you say, they're being very tactical and not entering into the broader issues that have paralyzed Lebanon for some time, but are rather focusing on this one issue. These mountains of garbage have been piling up since July. So why is it that they can't figure out a contract about who gets the spoils to pick up the garbage, and now we're in September?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of money to steal. And, you know, this is exactly the same reason why there's no 24-hour electricity supply here a quarter of a century after the end of the Civil War, because a diesel and generator mafia makes so much money off of electricity interruptions, and long ago, the government figured out where and how to build new power plants, and the major warlords can't agree on who gets how, what share of the jobs and what share of the money that would go through these power plants. So they never got built. And it's the same thing here. The detailed backstory is sort of interesting too, because the existing garbage contract goes to a company that's controlled by Saad Hariri, the sort of Sunni strongman whose father rebuilt downtown Beirut and is, you know, one of a handful of Lebanese billionaires. And so this guy sort of strong-armed his way into getting the entire garbage concession. And so when it came up, there was this sort of overt sectarian overtone where, you know, the other warlords were irritated that for such a long time the one Sunni kingpin had the monopoly on the garbage money. And so that's part of why this one has been so thorny. In other arenas of corruption, which are, you know, maybe too boring to go into the details of, the spoils are shared among the different sects and between the different warlords. So everyone, you know, every major player gets their cut. So no one really has an incentive to, you know, to sort of play the spoiler and block it. But on the garbage deal, it didn't work out that way. And I think they believed that the can would get kicked down the road because, you know, last year there was almost the same crisis when when the landfill where all the garbage goes to, which was supposed to be shut down more than 5 years ago, the town around that landfill said, enough, you know, you were supposed to find a new place 5 years ago, you never did, we're blockading the roads. And for about a week, no garbage trucks could get in. And then they were bought off, persuaded to wait a year. And I think everyone at the top thought that would happen with this, that somehow magically it would get kicked down the road. But, you know, they've tried the patience of the people of this country quite dearly. And I guess they're beginning to find the breaking point.
So instead of kicking it down the road, it's now stacked on the streets. I mean, it's got to be.
And it's not just one can, right? It's,
no.
You know,
mountains and mountains.
Thousands.
So you mentioned Saad Hariri, the son of the former president who was assassinated, presumably by Hezbollah. He was a joint Lebanese-Saudi citizen and was a conduit for a ton of Saudi money. So he who has the most money still doesn't work there?
No, it's a very delicate equilibrium, and it has to do not just with, I mean, there are lots of rich and powerful tycoons in this country. Although Hariri was the most prominent internationally, there are others, and there's also the fact of who has militias and who has militant constituencies that can shut the country down. So, for example, the Shia Amal movement, which you never hear about in the States, right? You always hear about Hezbollah, you never hear about Amal. Amal is the slightly older, slightly more quiescent Shia movement. They are tremendously tied into every corrupt patronage scheme in the country because they have a shrewd leader, Nabi Berri, who's the Speaker of Parliament, and because they do have a strong street game. And so when Nabi Berri demands a cut of a construction contract or of a factory or of some other concession, if he doesn't get it, suddenly hundreds of violent saboteurs will show up and make problems for whoever's running this concession that wasn't shared out that way. So the control doesn't just flow to the richest person. And what happens because it's a completely untransparent and completely sort of ad hoc and corrupt system, the powerful people don't actually know how it's going to play out. So every time there's a new renegotiation of anything from, you know, appointing the new chief of staff of the military to something like this garbage contract, people are end up engaging in brinkmanship and often damaging their own interests because they don't know, honestly, how it's going to play out. And since there's no, you know, there's no fair process, there's no rule of law, there's no, you know, there's no other structure to smooth things out, you know, we get confrontations like 2008 where Hezbollah took over West Beirut, or the fact that there hasn't been a new president elected in this country for more than a year. You know, these are sort of crazy vacuums, and they occur because there is no actual functional system to default to.
So you're describing a kind of group of rival mafia bosses who are bleeding the country, but they're unregulated. And even in the Godfather movies, you know, the dons at least got together occasionally and divvied up the territory. You get, you know, to sell heroin here and you get to have prostitution here, etc. That's not happening, right?
That's a great metaphor. I mean, you know, one can take it too far, but I actually think that's the right kind of way to understand it. So if you want to pull the Godfather metaphor, it wasn't smooth, right? I mean, there were these crazy gangland turf battles where families would decimate each other. And, you know, as in this sort of famous Marlon Brando scene where he says, you know, this is bad for business. But you know, like, why did it play out that way? Because there wasn't a clear process by which they could adjudicate who controls which, you know, turf for heroin or for prostitution. And that's the same kind of problem here. And it really is a similar kind of dynamic where things only get resolved, whether it's the end of the Lebanese Civil War, whether it's the expulsion of the Syrians in 2005, whether it's the rejiggering of the Hezbollah's share of power in 2008, and so on. These things only get resolved after a humongous crisis and a crisis that reaches a breaking point. And it's only typically in the last 30 years, it's only when the Lebanese state looks like it's about to fall off a precipice into mass violence that the leaders get finally serious about reaching a compromise. And every time, the compromise they end up agreeing to is usually the obvious compromise agreement that had been proposed at the very beginning of the crisis.
Well, it's kind of unusual, though, that Thanasi Kambanis, that we're actually having a conversation that's not about the civil war next door in Syria, the flood of refugees that have swamped Lebanon, and the tensions with Israel and Hezbollah, and the new tensions on the Golan Heights. Obviously, none of those are going away, right? This is just, I guess, you can't avoid piles of garbage, right? The You Stink movement sprung up because of this, you know, pungent reality.
Right, and my view is that the truth in Lebanon is the same as the truth throughout the Arab world, which is eventually citizens' demands to be treated decently and to have some say over the way they're governed have to be addressed. I mean, you know, this is a region where misgovernance has been endemic, and the sort of raft of security nightmares, the sort of litany of conflicts that you just ran through, have been always trundled out as an excuse for why, you know, why we can't have more democracy or why we can't have a better system now. And people are just have been sick of it for a long time, and that underlay the Arab uprisings of 2010 and 2011, and those grievances remain very real all over the region. I mean, everywhere except Tunisia, frankly, has been, you know, there's been almost no measurable progress on these fronts, you know, just representation and governance, not miracles, not like a ideal democracy, but just some improvement after 50 years or more of waiting. And that anger is going to keep bubbling forward and bubbling over and creating movements like this one now, until that changes. And I'm frankly happy to see the sort of resilience of these citizens groups and these idealists to keep on bringing these things up to the fore, even though there are these other pressures and people at the top can say, hey, you know, now's not a good time because of the war next door here, the war next door there, the refugee crisis, the this and that. And they say, you know what? You know, like, there always is going to be another problem facing our country, yet we have to deal with the fact that you aren't governing.
Well, it's not as if there aren't any other examples around the world. I mean, this sounds very similar to what's happening in Malaysia, where the citizens are just fed up with an incompetent and corrupt leader. So, you know, it does have a kind of resonance around the world, doesn't it?
Or in Greece, or the indignados in Spain. I mean, right? This is a sort of universal response to needless suffering caused by callous and indifference governance.
So, just to finish up then, Thanasi Kambanis, we've been covering, of course, the refugee crisis in Europe, but it all originates in your neighborhood there, with Lebanon having taken in an enormous number of Syrian refugees, I think of something like a quarter of its own population. Jordan, which is a very, very overburdened country to begin with, has taken in millions, and so has Turkey, and they spent about $5 billion on humanitarian aid. So why aren't the European powers dealing with the situation at its roots? And now suddenly they're shock, shock, shock. It's all happening on our doorstep.
Well, I mean, it would be great if the European countries and the United States recognized that addressing the crisis in Syria would solve a lot of other spillover problems, right? And if they actually tried to contain ISIS and promote a political solution and help refugees both where they are and where they end up, you know, those would be huge steps. But, you know, I think what you're really asking is, why aren't Western governments smarter, wiser, and more visionary in their foreign policy? And, you know, obviously that's been a generational failure, and I don't think we should expect that to change anytime soon.
Well, Thanasi Kambanis, I thank you so much for joining us here tonight.
All right, take care, Ian.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. And he joined us from Beirut. We can take a brief station break. We're back examining the undeclared cyber war underway between the U.S. and China and the U.S. and Russia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is August Cole, a writer and analyst specializing in national security issues and a former defense industry reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, where he directs the Art of Future Warfare Project, and he's the co-author with Peter Singer of Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. Welcome to Background Briefing, August Cole.
It's great to be here.
And speaking of the next world war, it would seem to me that, in effect, we already are in an undeclared cyber war with China and perhaps to a lesser extent an undeclared cyber war with Russia. Would you agree with that?
Well, this is a really tough question in Washington right now. You know, we are used to the nomenclature of war being applied to all kinds of policy problems. Of course, that goes back to the war on drugs. I don't think we're in cyber war right now for the very reason that an actual confrontation at a global scale with a country like China would result in something far more even serious than what we've experienced so far. So we're seeing many of the tactics of cyber warfare. We're seeing something that has a sort of prelude, if you will, to actual conflict in the way cyber would be a battlefield domain in the same way we look at, let's say, the sea or the land. But it's not outright cyber war right now, and I think that's often a misconception that needs to be explored.
So what is the distinction? Is this the distinction between, say, a hit-and-run robbery by a bunch of criminals as opposed to a platoon attack by a military group?
Well, that's a really interesting way to think about it. I mean, the big challenge is understanding that the way a nation state, a big country like Russia or China, prepares for actual conflict now is often done years in advance in the cyber domain. An example for that would be the theft of documents from the Office of Personnel Management. And you might say, well, gosh, you know, nobody likes paperwork and no one's ever gone to war over paperwork. And that's probably true. But in stealing the background files for as many as 21 million Americans, what China's done is given itself a leg up in the sorts of spying that can get you technological backdoors into U.S. Economic systems, into the military's own networks. And that's what they're constantly doing. Of course, the U.S. is quite good at this as well, and it's something we pursue regularly as well. This is one of the byproducts of the Edward Snowden revelations. And so this question of whether the framework is something akin to a smash and grab or a hit and run somebody trying to break into your house to steal your actual credit card out of your wallet instead of stealing it online, I think one helpful way to think about it is akin to the state between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Both sides spied extensively on one another, and pretty much everything was fair game, except for one really important thing, is that there was no targeted killing of one another's officers. KGB officers did not regularly target CIA officers, even if they knew who they were. They might have tried to turn them, but they wouldn't kill them. And those sorts of red lines, I think, are important to establish with China, a sort of informal road rules of this very complicated age.
So you mentioned Edward Snowden, and I recall that Edward Snowden, when he was a young contractor, AT contractor with the CIA in Geneva, He tried to break into the director of operations computers and got caught. And for some reason or other, when he applied for the job at the NSA or with the NSA contractor, Booz Hamilton, the details about his being red flagged did not get into the employment file. And I've spoken to a number of CIA people, and they said, well, you know, it's these damn contractors. You know, we're hiring all these contractors to do this kind of work. And a lot of them use minimum wage workers, and they're not particularly sharp. And my understanding is with the breach that you just talked about, the Office of Personnel Management, the OPM breach, that was largely made possible because of a government contractor who didn't secure the data.
This is one of the big challenges in services contracting right now. It's easy to win a contract. It's hard to fulfill. We saw this on the security side, for example, where small companies would receive very lucrative contracts to protect, let's say, diplomats overseas. But to get and hire the actual number of elite former soldiers to perform that contract as you'd promised is a lot harder than actually winning it, in part because there aren't really that many of a certain kind of, let's say, commando if you're trying to protect a State Department officer. So in the case of Snowden and in this larger question of managing federal IT infrastructure, it is as big a problem as we can literally imagine. And the government does not have the in-house expertise to do so and has tried to, you know, work with the private sector to get as much value on one hand, but also kind of reliability and consistency. And oversight of this has just been incredibly complicated, as you point out, and not very effective. And going forward, this is obviously the kind of loophole that has to be plugged. You know, if, as in the case of OPM, there was IT work being outsourced actually to China for U.S. government systems, that makes no sense. And that kind of, you know, thing needs to be checked and changed. And I think some of the outrage and in Congress and some of the scrutiny, both private and public, in the last couple months is hopefully going to be helpful around this. The challenge, I think, though, is coming up with a solution that works. The U.S. has gotten, I mean, to our previous question here, really good at offensive operations. We can air gap networks, meaning steal things from computers that aren't even on the internet, which is a mind-blowing thing for a layman like me to conceive of. But at the same time, we still operate COBOL language computer networks and vital systems and see our unsecured, unclassified emails hacked by the Russians, as the Joint Chiefs of Staff found out recently. And so there is a kind of large and growing gap between what we want to be able to do and what we can do, and that's not going to get any narrower anytime soon if we keep with the status quo.
And again, I'm speaking with August Cole, who's a writer and analyst specializing in national security issues and a former defense industry reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, where he directs the Art of Future Warfare Project, and he's the co-author with Peter Singer of Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. So when you just told our audience, August, that not only was the OPM breach apparently conducted by the Chinese, that they were subcontracting some of the cyber protection necessary to protect this data to Chinese companies, I hope that Donald Trump's not listening to this conversation.
Well, I mean, this is the challenge. You know, we have so much wonderful technology now at our fingertips as civilians. Globalization has brought us, you know, iPhones that are, you know, only a few hundred dollars that do, you know, extraordinary things. It makes the way we thought about personal communication a decade ago look almost prehistoric. And so the challenge here for government as well is, how do you, in this time of, you know, fiscal scrutiny of, you know, candidates and, you know, for the White House who want to reduce government spending on just about everything, how do you then ensure you have an adequate and resourced way of getting as much technology out there from the private sector into the public domain so you can replicate a lot of that efficiency and convenience that we have gotten used to in our daily lives? And it's just really hard to do. The defense world is struggling with this. That's why last week Defense Secretary Ash Carter was in Silicon Valley for a second trip this year, making his overtures to try to onboard as much know-how from that community where failure is accepted and doesn't result in a congressional oversight hearing. I mean, it's really hard to take risks in Washington with new ideas, especially around high-tech spending, where there's often a lot of wasted money. The venture capital sector is used to that. That's part of the risk analysis profile that any investor makes. The U.S. government does not function well in that kind of a paradigm. And so when we think about what is the future of this U.S.-China sort of cyber relationship at the strategic level, a lot of it will come from our ability to become more resilient with the systems we buy, the way we manage our contractors, as you pointed out, and the expectations we set within our own bureaucracy, because a lot of this starts from the top. You know, the White House has articulated a real priority for cybersecurity, but hasn't fulfilled, I think, a lot of what has been expected in terms of getting a deep understanding early on in the Obama administration of the problems at hand and not seeing it as much from the point of view of the people who are most often being hacked in industry.
But you would have thought, though, that the sensitive information about people who apply for jobs in the Secret Intelligence Services, and there's a whole alphabet soup of them, particularly with the NSA, which is supposedly the most secretive of all, if all of that personnel data and resumes and health information, I mean, I understand that the Chinese are doing multiple hacks, not just from the OPM files, which give you all of the personal data on the individuals, but then you can buttress that with medical data and cross-reference. And you can even get, you know, look into the hack for Ashley Madison to see whether any of these people are having affairs, and then you can blackmail them. I mean,
that's right. This is the line of thinking that if you are a digital spy master in the 21st century, you have to be looking for the kinds of opportunities that aren't singular. It's not stealing the design for one missile or one entire aircraft. It's rather stealing the personal information of the people designing and building that aircraft and leveraging your ability to access their networks, either through coercion, either through simple trickery. You know, the Department of Homeland Security has quite a bit of open source information on the kinds of hacks that are being perpetrated against, like, for example, natural gas infrastructure firms. And those are really interesting to read because you see some of the tradecraft that's being exploited by nation states, but also private groups too. And one of the most common and effective techniques they've found, and this is something the Defense Department has also identified in its weapons programs, most of which have been you know, penetrated, is tricking people into clicking on emails that aren't really actually from the sender they think it is. And so instead they download a virus, you know, a keylogging program, something really, you know, noxious, onto their system. And what it does is it gives that hacker, that cyber spy, one more level of access into a very protected network through someone who doesn't even realize they're making a mistake. It's the unwitting mark, you know, to kind of put it in the crime novelist, you know, parlance. And that is really hard to combat because it requires a level of diligence and awareness that a lot of us, I think, struggle to maintain on our own, you know, personal technology. I mean, think of how many people just have their birthdays for their passwords or use the word password for a password, things that we're told repeatedly not to do. It's kind of like the junk food equivalent of, you know, eating an extra serving of ice cream. You know you're not supposed to do it, but it's harder to not do it than it is to do it.
But you still would have thought, though, that we would have been more aware of these vulnerabilities, particularly in terms of resumes and of personnel joining the intelligence service. I mean, I know that, for example, at least I read this, that somewhere up in Silicon Valley, I think it was the CIA, or, you know, hiring a bunch of screenwriters to come up with all kinds of future scenarios for fictional situations that could become fact. How is that a myth, or is there something to that? And if so, are we thinking, as they say, outside of the box?
The box that the national security establishment, let's start with that, is within right now is expanding, and that's a good start. But the acceleration, the metabolism is probably a better word for the kinds of problems that we face, whether it's terrorism, whether it's even the nation-state threat, a country like China, is moving so fast, and our systems are so slow to respond and aren't really oriented towards this really dynamic relationship with technology at the individual level. You know, people as an individual, as Snowden showed us, can do far more harm and good than they ever could before. And so that means to me that there is a real role for novelists, for writers, for screenwriters, as you pointed out, for video game designers to have a voice in the defense establishment, because there is a abiding, you know, hunger for good ideas. And I think a generation of mid-grade officers right now that are coming up in the ranks of the armed services, and I think this is true in the intelligence world too, who are hungry to change things and are waiting for their chance. And so part of the challenge now is how do you enable that? And that's some of what we're doing at the Art of Future Warfare Project. You know, how do you get a college kid from Chapman University, for example? We had a winner of one of our short story contests to share a stage and speak in front of an audience with military officials, diplomatic officials, to talk about his version of the future of warfare in the latter half of the 20th century. That's someone who'll never brief the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff any other way, but suddenly there you can have people really listening to new ideas that are sensible, that are creative, and that are actually able to be acted upon and offer new perspectives. So I'm hopeful that we're in the midst of a sea change. And I see some of it happening right now, but it's really hard work to do to push past the people who are your early adopters of this kind of new framework that want to break status quo, and really going into the deeper bureaucracy that is very wed to protecting budgets and programs. Because in Washington, what you spend is sort of who you are at that federal level. You know, how much budget you're allotted is often a very strong indicator of kind of how much clout you have in the political and congressional system. And the reality in the 21st century is we have to be a lot smarter than that.
But surely, August Cole, for the longest time, and, you know, espionage is the world's second oldest profession, you know, that you would have thought that, for the longest time, it's been clear that human foibles and human weaknesses are what are exploited. The KGB used to refer to it as a honey trap, where they'd find out what sexual predilection you might have and set you up in a sting and blackmail you. So there's nothing new about looking for people's vulnerability. And my understanding is that the Russian intelligence service, the FSB, used a Romanian hacker who was particularly good. He hacked into the email of Sid Blumenthal, who's a confidant of Hillary Clinton's, and that became a back door for emails. So that seems to me to be how the game is played.
You know, there are these views and visions of the future of espionage, the future of war, that are, you know, wholly wed to new technologies. But I think there are just as many, if not more, strands that go back in human history, you know, as back far as the Greeks and the Romans, to help us understand some of the way forward here. You know, the exploitation of human weakness is as old an art of in the espionage trade, as you point out, as there is. It's really the essence of it. And I don't think we should be surprised that it's getting more difficult, because we're able to find and probe and explore those weaknesses far easier than before as we become more connected. You know, each of us has more ports to the network, if you will, through our various devices, through the ways we can explore our interests, you know, nefarious or above the board as they might be. I mean, the Ashley Madison hack is a perfect example of that. There were plenty of people that were using their government email addresses on that. It makes no sense from a practical point of view if someone was looking to be deceptive or dishonorable, but yet there it is. People are doing things that aren't their self-interest, and that is just the kind of opportunity that a really talented spymaster would go after. It's really fertile ground for novelists and creatives right now, I have to say it.
Well, but for example, the CIA has a fairly hermetically sealed internet regime, and we know from what happened with General Petraeus that he thought he was being clever, and he wasn't. And it was pretty clear they were onto him right away. But my understanding is that that's a kind of two-way street. In other words, if you can find a way to insulate yourself against the outside world penetrating your net, you may be depriving yourself of the value of the net itself.
This is the paradox. You know, the openness that we need to be up to date, the challenge the Pentagon faces is, you know, how to get the best software coders and engineers into the, you know, channel of intellectual property that's flowing into the Pentagon's brightest minds, into the Pentagon sort of Q-Lab workshops. If you follow the traditional red tape approach to buying software, to buying weapon systems, you'll never let those people in. You simply aren't opening yourself up to them. And so this paradox here of needing to be able to be open to the, you know, vast and really wonderful strains of information out there is very much part of the future of national security. And so the challenge really is, how do you manage that tension with of the risk? The other risk to point out as well is that the more you close yourself off, the more secure you may feel and the more vulnerable you may actually be. The sort of Maginot line, you know, concept, in that you build a massive defense against your adversary, and suddenly they come up with a wholly different way to penetrate your network, to steal what you most value. And so that, to me, is a mindset shift as well, that you simply can't go into work, assume you'll be safe, assume that everything you're doing will be free from intercept and free from sort of exploitation by an adversary. And rather, the approach is almost to be operating under the assumption that everything you are talking about, writing about, if you're in the defense establishment, is going to be purloined at some point by a foreign intelligence agency or a hacking group. You know, there's this adage in journalism, you know, the world that I came from, that, you know, if a source was talking to you, they might say to themselves, you know, don't say anything that you don't want to see in the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And that's often the case, you know, is that you're now at a point where anything that is put down on paper, even said over a phone for that matter, can end up into the public domain in a way that it really couldn't, you know, 10 years ago.
Well, just in closing, Chinese Premier Xi Jinping is arriving in a couple of weeks on a state visit to the White House. And the last time there was a visit with President Obama was out at Palm Springs when Xi was just ascended to the top leadership post. And on the eve of that visit, the Snowden leaks were published indicating that the U.S. had attacked China aggressively in terms of cyber warfare. And that particular leak on the eve of Xi's visit undercut Obama's arguments because he was about to complain to the Chinese leader. So what kind of complaints do you think the president can come up with that are going to mean something here in this sort of overt, covert war of, or half war of cyber espionage?
I think one of the strongest complaints is that the Chinese must not attack our national command authority networks, meaning the systems we use to control nuclear weapons. They should not penetrate our critical infrastructure like our, I would even say, electrical grids, but especially our nuclear civilian power plants. But also to have a message for President Xi, if you are President Obama, to say, you know, we're hacking you, you're hacking us, this is going to go on, but we need to establish some red lines we won't cross. One of the most dangerous things, I think, could be that if there were an inadvertent escalation of a conflict that was triggered in the cyber domain, I think that's the sort of existential risk that isn't often acknowledged enough. The duty and the hard work that information, you know, security officers face throughout the government isn't going to get any easier. It's going to get harder. But at least if it is done in a way that we know that there are boundaries and red lines to what I alluded earlier, that don't kill each other's clandestine officers, I think we're at least in a better path towards not having a kind of catastrophic outcome from these sorts of cyber operations. You know, we are not at cyber war, but we have to be aware that if we do see an escalation of conflict, that cyber will be a battle domain unlike the likes we've ever seen before.
Well, August Kohl, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for having me.
I did too. And again, I've been speaking with August Kohl, who's a writer and analyst specializing in national security issues and a former defense industry reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, where he directs the Art of Warfare project. And he is the co-author with Peter Singer of Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how Egypt's jails are overflowing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Noah Radwan, who is a professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley. She was born in Egypt and was among the participants in the Tahrir Square protests in 2011. Welcome to Background Briefing, Noah Radwan.
Thank you.
And much of the press has recently been focused on the sentencing of three Al Jazeera journalists in Egypt, two of whom were in custody and have now gone to jail, the third being in Australia. And of course, there was the high-profile presence of their lawyer, who happens to be married to a movie star, George Clooney, which seemed to get a lot of the headlines. But the point I think that needs to be made here, surely, is that along with these two journalists, there are at least 23 other journalists are being detained. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of young people who have been held for demonstrating. Three belly dancers have been accused of inciting debauchery. They've been jailed. And, of course, thousands and thousands of those alleged members of the Muslim Brotherhood, including their leadership, are also in jail. So, to my mind, that's the real story, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think you're right. I'm actually kind of disturbed by the fact that most of the headlines carry the story of two journalists from Al Jazeera. There are actually three. There's Peter Gressy, who's now in Australia. There's Mohammed Fahmy, who is the one whose family hired Amal Clooney as the lawyer. And then there's a third one who's actually in the worst situation of all three. His name is Beher Mohammed. Mohammed Fahmy's hope right now is to be able to get out of the country and be deported through this law that President Sisi passed, almost half a year ago, making it possible for people who have a citizenship other than Egyptian to be deported to another country. Mohammed Fahmy is Egyptian and Canadian, and he can be deported to Canada. Beher Mohammed is Egyptian with no other place to go to, so he's going to languish in jail. This is, as you said, this is just the tip of the iceberg as far as political repression and, repression of dissent in Egypt goes. We are, at a time when there are other journalists that most people outside of Egypt have not heard of, who have been in jail with no trial for more than 2 years now. In addition to, as you mentioned, thousands of political activists who have been in prison for nothing more than participating in a demonstration nonviolently or blogging or, maybe even tweeting or putting something on their Facebook page.
Well, my understanding is that the jails are so full that they're actually overflowing in Egypt.
This is absolutely true. When I was in Egypt last, I met with a journalist whose name is Ahmed Kamel Dieda. And Ahmed was arrested in December 2013 and released in April 2015. He was not guilty of any charges. But he did spend over a year in prison. And he has been writing on, his own website and actually for one of the newspapers. He stopped the conditions of his imprisonment. He described being in a cell with 74 other people with barely more than 2 feet for every one of these people. The conditions are horrible. And there is something called the National Council for Human Rights in Egypt that goes to visit these prisons. But Ahmed also describes how these visits are really a sham because the worst conditions are hidden from the National Council that is not really interested in uncovering the horrendous conditions in Egyptian prisons. So you're right about that, too. Every day in prison is a day too much for innocent people.
And again, I'm speaking with Noha Radwan, who is a professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley. She was born in Egypt and was among the participants in the Tahrir Square protests of 2011. So, Noha, just to put this, though, in a historical context, it seems that almost since in the modern post-World War II age, if you will, Egypt has largely been run by military governments, and now they've returned to a military government. So I can't imagine there's much of a constituency for those who support. I know that the Tamarud movement seemed to get conned into going after the Muslim Brotherhood and then suddenly enabling the comeback of the military. But give me a sense, if you will, of how the Egyptian people feel about the idea of endless military rule.
To say that Egypt has been under military rule since the Second World War is a statement that is in general true but needs to be qualified. Because, yes, it's true that the Egyptian presidents successively have come from the ranks of the military. But there hasn't been that much of a military presence in civil life in Egypt for a long time, since really the 1950s, when, Nasser's government was heavily militarized and there was a lot of military presence on the streets. But what we're seeing right now is actually something very disturbing, which is the complete subjugation of the judiciary to the political apparatus in Egypt, so that there hasn't even been any attempt since the ouster of President Morsi in 2013 to have, you know, the basic judiciary procedures, the basic respect for the law. The Egyptian courts have been handing sentences that are really absurd, and they're also not honoring the maximum time that people can spend in prison before, you know, before being put for trial. I can give you an example of a photojournalist. His name is Mahmoud Abouzeid, known as Shokin. There are lots of websites that go, you know, that publicize his case with that name, who has been in jail since the dispersal of the Rabaa sit-in, which was August 2013. He has been in prison since then, and he hasn't stood trial yet. And so that you know, that kind of disregard for the judiciary, disregard for legal processes is kind of unprecedented in Egypt. Really, maybe it's a return to the 50s, but throughout the last few decades, there has been at least a semblance of respect for the legal process that, you know, is now deteriorating.
So then could you try and get a comparison or get a better handle on what you're telling us, Manoah? Would Putin's Russia be an example where the judiciary has been totally politicized and dissent has been criminalized?
Yes, it is true that all forms of dissent in Egypt have now been criminalized. It is very dangerous to publish against the government, so freedom of expression is now dangerous and punishable. And then all forms of assembly and demonstration are also prohibited, especially under this new law that is called anti-terrorism law that was passed on August 17, just a couple weeks ago. And it is, it always shocks me how, in the name of anti-terrorism, governments can pass laws that are really scary and repressive. Of course, this goes because of the myth that repressive governments and autocratic regimes and military rule can, in fact, crush terrorism. And, you know, the truth is the exact opposite. It actually fosters terrorism and it increases its presence. So Egypt is, again, in one of those situations where, you know, you find that most of the public is complacent with this wave of repression because they think that this is the way to eliminate terrorism. In my mind, that actually does the exact opposite, and that the only way to eliminate terrorism is to, in fact, encourage freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of, you know, nonviolent protests, and to improve the economic situation in Egypt, which really is the main reason why the revolution started in the first place, because of the disparity in income and wealth between members of the Egyptian society.
Well, my understanding was that the public just simply couldn't stomach the idea of Mubarak's son taking over. That was kind of the symbol, was it not, of a kind of sclerotic dynasty?
I think for the vast majority of Egyptians, many of them, I mean, we're talking about a population where 40% of that population lives below poverty line. For most of them, if you can secure good living and employment and education and health care, you know, the basic necessities, whether it's Mubarak or his son or his, you know, mother-in-law, it didn't really matter to them a whole lot. It was just the fact that they were seeing this autocratic regime being less and less concerned about the everyday conditions of life in Egypt.
So my understanding, though, is that, you know, we're in our foreign policy, we're so much in denial about the role of Saudi Arabia in so many of the problems that the world faces, not to mention the United States. If you look at Daesh, the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, the Taliban, etc., they all have, in many ways, at least the religious and ideological underpinning of Saudi Wahhabism. So we seem to be completely in denial about that, but there can't be any denying that the Saudi Arabians basically have been funding Sisi, didn't they? I mean, it was such a coincidence. The minute that Sisi came back after the Muslim Brotherhood got toppled.
Yes, I actually believe that one of the reasons they're funding him is they may think that he is capable through these repressive measures and, you know, an iron fist to control the spread of militant Islamic movements. And to crush the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'm not sure if you're aware that, you know, the Brotherhood has branches in just about every Arab and Islamic country, including Saudi Arabia. And the Saudi government does not want to see, you know, more power go towards the Brotherhood. So they're interested in having him crush the Brotherhood and curb the, you know, the militant Islamic movements in the Arab world. And I think he's actually incapable of doing either one of those things. And, you know, it's, again, the Saudis subscribe to the myth that I just spoke about, that more repression will lead to an end of terrorism.
Well, of course, but the Saudis are not the only people that are opposed, for example, to Obama's deal with Iran. The Israelis are incredibly opposed to, at least Prime Minister Netanyahu is. And there again, there seems to be a peculiar tacit alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And clearly the Israelis are just as upset and paranoid about the Muslim Brotherhood as the Saudis are. The Saudis just don't want any alternative to their kind of medieval monarchy, and this is a very viable alternative of political Islam, certainly a lot more progressive than the Saudi model. But from the Israeli point of view, I'm sure they breathe a huge sigh of relief when the Saudis help bring Sisi back.
I mean, I do agree with you with all my reservations and concerns about the Brotherhood. I think they are a better alternative to the Saudi model. And I'm completely opposed to the idea of labeling them a terrorist organization, which is something that President Sisi's government has done since the ouster of Mohamed Morsi in 2013. There is absolutely no proof that the Brotherhood has been involved in anything that can be called terrorism. There is, however, ample evidence that 1,500 of Morsi's supporters were killed in a massacre by the military government and by the Egyptian police in August 2015. So you tell me who's the terrorist in this case. Yeah, I do agree with you. I think we have to you know, look at international involvement in this, including the Saudi, of course. But I don't want to make too many comments about, the relationship between the Saudis, the Israelis, and the Iranians, and the American administration at this point. I think that's a little too complicated and too complex for what we want to deal with in 59.
Well, I agree, and we'll certainly be hearing a lot more of it as the clock ticks on when the Senate and the House get to vote. So we'll have plenty of coverage on that. Noah, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Noah Radwan, who's a professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley. She was born in Egypt and was among the participants in the Tahrir Square protests in 2011. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.